It's all right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the first of the RALSE series for this semester, Height, Spread, Impact. My name's Kate Goodwin. I'm the curator of the architecture program at the Royal Academy of Arts. And this evening I'm just going to very briefly introduce the series. The series started about 5 years ago, and it's a collaboration between the Royal Academy's architecture program and the LSE Cities program. It aims to examine issues that relate to the city within a social, urban and aesthetic context. This current series will look at height, spread, impact. Each aspect is examined in a pairing of lectures, one held in this term and the second one being in the Lent term 2006. The aim is to take a case study presented by the architect of the project and examine it in further detail with a panel of respondents. The panel will be made up of a representative from the LSE and chair this evening, Robert Tavener, who's the Professor of Architecture and Urban Design and Director of the LSE Cities Program. From the RA, we have Jeremy Melvin, who's an architectural journalist and historian. Then we have two panellists who bring a particular knowledge of the aspect of scale we're studying or the project being discussed. And this evening, we've got Mike Edwards, who's the economic planner at the Bartlett UCL, and Joanna Avery, head of enabling at CAVE. So I'll just hand over to our chair for this evening, Robert Tavener.
Thank you, and good evening to you all. This is my first public appearance at the LSE, so it's interesting how different places handle these occasions, but as Kate said, we're going to ask the two speakers to present first and then have the panellists come up and respond, really as a way of agitating responses from you. So we're going to hope that you're going to be sufficiently excited about all of this to speak your mind in from whatever direction you're coming from, because I suppose part of the excitement of having the LSE as a forum is that there are people from many different backgrounds here. I'm delighted that the first of this series is being led by Graham Morrison and Dimitri Porphyrios. They, I confess, are two old friends, and I admire their work for very different reasons. But there's also a thread that connects them, and that is their ability to respond directly to a place, to understand what a site is about, and to propose something which ideally will become seamless with the environment that exists there, that will be a very positive response both to the culture of the place, the topography of that part of the city. So that's really what I'm hoping we're going to see in the presentation today, a reaction to King's Cross, why they've dealt with it in a particular way. And I guess it's for the panellists and you to decide whether or not they have set about this humendous task in the right manner. But anyway, if I can invite Graham Morrison up first, please.
Well, good evening from me too. This is Bob's first presentation to you. It's probably my first and my last, I think. I should start by saying that although this is an enormous site and it's been a great privilege to be working on the site of King's Cross, it's very, very much a collaboration between the firms of Allies and Morrison and Porphyrios Associates. But it's also much more than that, because it's a collaboration between a series of designers, but an extraordinarily committed client in the form of Argent. I mean, I don't think anybody who's met a client like Argent have come across anybody quite like it. And I don't honestly think the project could have been effectively done without them. And it would be, although one of the following protagonists is a representative from CABE, it would be churlish of me not to acknowledge CABE's involvement, and particularly English Heritage, because the advice and help that we've had throughout the journey of the master plan has been considerable. Now, you'll find when we start looking at some slides that the project that we've generated has come from very much an understanding of the site and an understanding of the problem. So we're interested both in the place but also how development works. It's not based on heroic geometries or gestures. and it certainly seeks to avoid the prescriptive in favour of the flexible. But of course, this is for you to judge. So we stand here all nervous in front of you. Before I start, just some statistics. This is, after all, the London School of Economics. It's 27 hectares, the site area. 40% of it is public open space in the form of streets, squares and parks. The total built development is just under 750,000 square metres, and that includes 450,000 square metres of commercial space, 45,000 square metres of retail, and approximately 2,000 homes. Amongst the many other uses will be a new primary school and several creches. Right, can I start with the first slide? Do I have to do that? Yeah, okay, right. So, King's Cross, where is it? And here's the aerial view. It's not entirely contemporary, but more or less it is. And you can see, if I follow the red dot here, here's St. Pancras Station and the big extension of the railway arc, which is going to take trains to Paris. That's the Eurostar will come through here. And then, of course, King's Cross itself with the Euston Road and Bloomsbury to the south. King's Cross is the centre of this map. You can see the scale of the site relative to, say, St. James's Park, just down here. And it's bigger than St. James's Park. And each of these three annular rings represents about a 10-minute walk. So from the centre, it's about 10 minutes to there, a further 10 minutes to here, and a total of half an hour almost to the river. So it sort of places that in London. And it in itself is about 15 minutes leisurely walk from one end to the other. From now on, we're turning the map on its side. It's a long story why this happened, but it happened. And north, you should regard, unless we tell you, is now to the right-hand side of the page. So there's the river, and there's St. James's Park that I just mentioned, and here is the site. And you can see what a big hole the site leaves in the urban fabric. And it's currently traversed by the Regent's Canal. Going closer in, the site is sort of shaped by the presence of, we saw earlier in the photograph, St. Pancras Station here and King's Cross, producing this very small mouthpiece or funnel onto Euston Road. And then it's characterised by York Road coming through up towards the north. York Way coming up towards the north. And then the massive CTRL embankment, that's the cross-channel rail link embankment carrying the Eurostar, which comes across here and then is tunnelised back to Ashford. And although the what's happened is that the effect of this embankment has to place the site geographically in Islington, but of course politically it's in Camden. And one of the problems that we've got to deal with is the ability to make connections through areas like that. And that sort of lack of permeability has been a problem from the start. But it's not so in relation to elsewhere. I was mentioning the Eurostar to Paris. It'll soon be 2 hours and 20 minutes to Paris from King's Cross. There's also the national network of trains to the north and indeed the suburban network of trains to Cambridge. Underground, this is a project to do with the ticket halls. That's St. Pancras, and this is King's Cross here. I can barely see it at my angle. But underground, there are six tube networks running through, connecting to 13 bus routes. And, of course, from that position, it's only a 10-minute walk to Camden Lock. Now, it wasn't always like that. This is 1766, and it's the same site. 250 years ago, almost. And you can see the word Pancras because the Church of St. Pancras is just sitting here. And what you're getting travelling across the site is the Fleet River running through, which ends up almost in Fleet Street, but currently in a tunnel. Now, 1834, shortly later, the canal has come in, the Regent's Canal. This came in at 1820, and the gasworks sitting here came in at 1827, along with the smallpox hospital. So technology also brought disease. And so, but you can see the city starting to creep northwards. A mere 30 years later, and the railways have completely taken off. And this is an extraordinary amount of building that's happened within a very short period of time. And here there's two railheads. First of all, there's the goods railhead. This is actually corn coming through into what the building known as the granary, which then delivered down into barges in that basin around the canals into London. And there was also coal came into here, and you'll see more of these two buildings later. But the Midland Railway forced its way through a bottleneck underneath the canal, up to the other side, and then into the station itself with the great double arch that you can see marked here. And of course, those of you who have travelled north from King's Cross know that steep incline that goes out of the station under the canal and then up the other side. Gasworks is also extended. 1894, another 30 years, and it just shows the sort of competitive power of Victorian industry. Here you've got King's Cross Station, as described before, with various sidings coming off here. But in addition to what we had in 1860, we've got this massive change of the St. Pancras Viaduct coming through, right the way through onto St. Pancras Station. So the platforms of King's Cross are a whole story height lower than St. Pancras. You go up to that level. And nobody cared at all about the kind of space that you might have had in between. It was what you see here, which is a sort of visible demonstration of unplanned competition, is what you got. And that even extended all the way through to the goods yards, which was later to be the site of the British Library. Now, this is 1999, and it's more or less like this at the moment. And the British Library has now been built. The site overall is effectively derelict. And the St. Pancras station is just awaiting its major extension to take the longer trains for their European journeys. And this will be the plan in 2007, where here you see the familiar shape of the site that we showed you earlier. That's the viaduct link coming in from Europe, coming through here, effectively forming that sort of sealed embankment, almost like a medieval wall, under which the canal then flows. And then that takes you into the main extension to St. Pancras here. And that effectively is the site that we've inherited for the planning of the master plan for King's Cross. However, there are a series of listed buildings. There's 22 listed buildings, of which there's a whole group here. We'll be seeing more of these later. And it's left an incredible Victorian industrial heritage, which of course has to be respected and enjoyed. The area, the built area of these listed buildings is 33,000 square metres, which is the same size as six football pitches. So it's a considerable impact on the discipline of the master plan. And just to look at a few of these, this is the face of the granary as it now is today. The length of that building, which you can see in Cubitt's painting at the time of its construction, is the width of Buckingham Palace. And here we see the canal boats going into receive corn drops from the warehouse above that have just received corn from the trains. And of course that led to a network of canals that has a completely different sense of scale from the busy industry above. And at King's Cross, the Regent's Canal widens. This is looking west. And in the distance there you see the gas holders, which produce this extraordinarily iconic entrance to St. Pancras that many of us are familiar with. This, in fact, the reason it looks such a cat's cradle is that the three gas holders are known as the triplets, and they're all intertwined and structurally dependent, but they're the tallest gas-holding structures in the world. Further along the canal, you get amusing buildings like this, which are sort of similarly amusingly called fish and coal. Why they were called fish and coal, I don't know, but this is a very sort of thin Victorian office building looking onto the canal. And of course it also left a fantastic legacy of its industrial landscape with turntables and railways and different kinds of stones set into the ground. and dominated by the two big railway stations. And of course, this is St Pancras with the this is 1874 with the Barlow shed, actually 74 metres across. And in the foreground is the German gym, which has just been restored. And inside you can see lots of athletics going on. The story goes that this is the building in which the modern Olympic movement was born. The first conversations were held in this building. And it's of interest to note that King's Cross will now be 7 minutes by train to Stratford International in the Olympics of 2012. So to summarise, we don't have anything like a greenfield site. There's the geometry of Somers Town to the west, there's the geometry of Islington to the east, there's the viaduct coming through here, there's the grain of all of the original fanning railways spreading out as fast as they could to drop their loads, and then there's the pinching mechanism of the competitive nature between St Pancras Station and King's Cross. That's on top of a 12-metre fall from the top on the north to the bottom sets the scene for the master plan. So I'm going to ask Dimitri to pick up at this stage, and then I'm going to follow after Dimitri and then sort of take you on a walk around the result of the principles that Dimitri will now describe.
Every master plan, every good master plan must have an idea. And the simplest the idea it is, probably the best, the better it may actually become in the future, because as we do know in life, things actually take forever to do. And there are so many people and so many ideas and so many pressures actually coming between clients, designers, authorities, etc. So the simplest the idea, probably the better. I would like to think that the idea that both Alison Morrison and ourselves, the first associates, have actually come up with, it may be simple, but probably or hopefully it's not simplistic. But before actually I describe the principles which gave rise to the plan that we've actually put forward for planning consent, we'd like to say a few things about master plans. You have to bear with me because I can't really see very well. I said that a master plan actually needs a vision. What does that mean? I suppose it's a very big word. It needs a philosophy of life. That's even a bigger word. It needs a set of civic values, I suppose, which would help define the physical aims of the master plan itself. And our vision, and when I say our, I mean Alison Morrison, Perfus Associates, and of course, as Graham actually mentioned very clearly, Argent, because without Argent, I don't think anything would have actually happened. Without the tenacity of Argent and the willingness to actually bring together all friends to work on such a very interesting project. The vision, which we may call our vision, had actually to do with the human city. Not the humanist city, but the human city. Humanist may actually involve us into other sort of philosophical discussion. The human city, what we mean by human city, I suppose, it's that city which blends, which mixes, which balances. World city, international functions, world city functions. And also on the other side, local needs. When we say, I suppose, or when I say human city, what one would like to understand is a city that balances investment, that balances economic development with the needs and aspirations of local communities. At the same time, the human city is a city that balances scale, that balances size, that balances numbers. Not necessarily proportionally, but a certain balance is actually established. And when we say balance, we mean something. One ends up with something that is not aggressive, something that does not celebrate transgression, something that does not celebrate aggressiveness, which is fortunately, or unfortunately, rather sort of fashionable today. It is above all, the human city above all, is that which actually balances the private and the public. The res privata, the private realm, and the public, the res publica. It is that which actually balances the personal and private urges and interests that we all have as individuals, as families, as communities, whatever, et cetera, rather, you know, moving from the single element or individual to the community or the group. And on the other side, civic values, civic aims, whether that means London, whether that means England, whether that means Europe, whether that means the world, whether that means the human race. It is a city that contributes to London specifically, economic growth. We would like to think that our master plan actually contributes or will contribute to the economic growth of London. It is a city, or it will be a city, which improves local opportunities at the same time for jobs, for living, for healthcare, for education, for the local communities around and in the vicinity of that area. It is a city that enhances the townscape. It enhances the public realm. And it is a city which adopts robust principles for sustainability. So all of that with this Albertian image. In other words, you can imagine what all of those words with this image here, and hopefully you can actually put them together. Now, what I want actually to talk about is about the devices, the means, and the principles for designing and delivering, not only designing, but designing and delivering such a human city. And it is our belief that those principles are actually inspired by the European city, by London, by Paris, by Vienna, by Florence, by Berlin, by Prague, by Barcelona, Stockholm. If I've forgotten another interesting city, please let me know, etc. Now, the first major principle in designing a human city, and more specifically, a principle that we've actually adopted in this plan, is that of the robust urban framework. As you do know, more successful places, and one does not have to be a planner for this, more successful places are actually marked by a physical framework. They are characterized, in other words, by a robust structure and sequence of streets, of squares, of parks, of gardens, etc., etc., which are all formed as open public rooms that are bounded by the buildings which constitute the urban blocks around them. For example, Covent Garden, the image that you see here, is one of those very successful spaces. Medium high density, extremely successful. You can see the way by which the main square is actually carved. You can actually see the public building that is actually, or buildings that is actually inserted there. You can actually see the porosity of all the fabric around it. Porosity meaning the manifold ways by which you can approach the main square, etc., etc. Now, there are many examples in London, and we don't have to go any further than London, which are actually desirable and beautiful places, The West End has many of them, Marylebone, parts of the city, and, you know, so on and so on. And establishing, I think, the right connections and spaces in the King's Cross redevelopment had been, when we started, and still remains to be, an essential first step in the making of a master plan. You've seen the context, as Graham actually described it very beautifully. And if you actually do start from the south side, which is, as he explained, on your left rather than the bottom of that image, the main square, the main and first square that one actually, or place of appearance that one has actually to define, is the space between St. Pancras and King's Cross, which is the large circle on your left. Another one, of course, is, and that is Station Square, eventually will become Station Square. Another one is, of course, the Granary Square, the smaller circle that we see here, which is just south of the Granary, which again, Graham actually showed Cubitt's drawing that you actually seen there. Now, what is important, of course, is not just the spaces, the connection is that red arrow. And if you take that a step further, in order to give a framework, a backbone to the whole site, you can actually see the red arrows as they actually move from left to right, from south to north. You can see the different sorts of open public spaces that one actually aims to establish throughout the site. And you can see some of the existing grey connections which may and may not exist already in the site and which, of course, have to be strengthened even more. And you can see the red ones, which are hopefully the ones that we would like to actually establish in order to make that strengthening even greater. Now, you can see here in this drawing a very simple sort of idea, which is that backbone, drawn, of course, as a figure ground, you may want to say, where a number of neighborhoods are actually established. You can see the backbone in the center. You can see those lines, the red lines that we saw. You can see on the left-hand side, the square, Station Square. You can see the main boulevard that will actually connect from Station Square to Granary Square. And then you can see this other sort of main open public space that is created here, which is a long park actually moving towards the north. And then you can see the neighborhoods, the grand mega blocks, the neighborhoods which are actually established already. And by that I mean specifically these triangles, that block here, those blocks, these blocks here. These are not really urban blocks. These are mega blocks. These are neighborhoods which eventually will be carved down into smaller blocks, etc. And you can see at the same time the east-west connections as they actually penetrate and move into the site itself. Now, the resulting framework, and this is the same plan drawn in a different manner in order to highlight this time not so much, or rather a balance between the built fabric and the unbuilt fabric. The resulting framework is, and that's, I think, quite crucial, at least in our minds, is legible. A good plan has to have a legible framework. It is permeable. A good plan has to have a porous, permeable framework. And it is robust. In other words, it allows the framework, the main spine, to actually remain almost intact in 50, 60, 100, 500, hopefully 1,000 years. But the actual blocks can actually change. And of course, the buildings can change even faster. So the second principle is that of adaptability. If the first one was that of a framework, the second principle of any master plan, and specifically this master plan here, is the issue of adaptability. And by that we mean adaptability and change. We mean that, as I mentioned before, that the mega blocks will actually change. These and those, all of those as a mega block will actually change. Within those, there will be different sort of urban blocks established. And within the urban blocks, there will be different buildings established. And what you see here is a very, very, very kind of inviting drawing, I suppose, which actually shows in this sort of transparent blue, it shows the overall sort of envelope of that mega block, and then within it, the different possibilities of how buildings can actually grow or not grow, and how they will actually change and wither away, and new buildings will come in, etc. So the framework has a lifespan of many years, whereas the urban blocks actually have a much smaller lifespan, probably 100 years, probably 150 years. And when you come to the buildings, they even have a smaller, probably, lifespan of about 20 or 30 years. The third principle is that of accessibility and connectivity, the way by which the grain of a city has to be very porous. The existing site of King's Cross, as Graham actually showed very clearly, is a dilapidated brownfield industrial site. And as such, actually it constitutes a large impediment to a north-south or east-west connection. Instead, a good master plan, and hopefully our master plan is good, must encourage maximum connectivity with the surrounding areas. In other words, what I want to actually stress here, that this is not really a gated community. We've seen gated communities throughout this country, not so many here, but we've seen gated communities in Germany, my God, and the worst of all, of course, in the United States. We do not intend this to be a gated community. It is a community or a group of neighborhoods which will actually connect and integrate through physical connections and, as I will mention later, through also use connections. So good accessibility and good permeability will give also economic and social value, making King's Cross Central a real place integrated with the surrounding neighborhoods. And that's an image to actually hopefully project in the future how it would actually integrate seamlessly with an A to Z map. The fourth principle is that of a range of mix or mixed use, a range of mix of uses. And this is a very important principle, obviously, because King's Cross must allow for a wide range of mix of uses. Places, as we know, that have only one use, say places which are only dormitories, places which are only residential, places which are only offices, places which are only retail, places which are only entertainment, etc., are actually dead places. They're alive for 2, 3, 4, 10 hours, whatever, but they're not alive 24 hours. And I think the trick in a real sort of city is to try and balance that sort of continuity of life throughout. And you can only balance that, not through ideas, but by mixing uses. So this drawing here actually shows that, visually at least, where the master plan that we propose has numerous sort of uses: housing, offices, workplaces, retail, education, healthcare, etc. More specifically, south of the canal, you can actually clearly see the retail, housing, and community mix of uses. And on the north side of the canal, you can actually see offices, housing, living, community uses, healthcare uses, retail, and also, because the site allows it over there, quite a lot of green. Graham very beautifully described the the existing site and the history of it. In other words, he described not only the physical site but the historical site, the site as it actually resides in the memory. And this is really what we have over there. I'm not going to go into that. He explained that. But this image actually leads me to the next principle, which is that of embedded heritage. And what I mean by that is that it is really a critical stance in a sense. Other people may say, well, it's actually quite banal. I don't see it like this. In other words, what is the banality of actually maintaining beautiful buildings? I would probably think that this is a critical moment, and it's a critical gesture to actually maintain beautiful buildings, and not only maintain and conserve and preserve beautiful buildings, but actually the group value of those buildings. And what we have here in King's Cross is not just individual objects left and right thrown like bricks, but they're actually creating already spaces between themselves. So that sort of group value of the buildings is something that is absolutely great and should be cherished. Now, to maintain these buildings or to preserve these buildings and to put them on a tabula rasa, to put them on a green field, to caress them and to cajole them and to actually think that they're like so important just because they carry with them some sort of historical dust, I think that is, or at least we find that to be rather sick. And it is very interesting that a lot of projects that we've seen on King's Cross have actually done exactly that. They've disengaged the traditional buildings, the historic buildings, from the new buildings, as if the two have nothing in common, and as if my grandmother and myself cannot actually breathe in the same room. What we're really proposing here is exactly that, that it would be possible, and not only possible, but advisable, and not only advisable, but actually absolutely fantastically beautiful to be able to live with your grandparents and your fathers and your great-grandparents all together in the same way that the great cities that we know and we all cherish and we go for holidays actually is there, the new and the old together. And this is the idea of embedding heritage, and that's what we're trying to actually do in this this image you've seen from Graham's, and you can actually see the background. This is here in order to show the geometrical sort of prehistory or history of the site vis-a-vis the converging lines of the trains. And you can see also how the geometry of that convergence is really reminiscent, or at least it is a reference. It may not be reminiscent in a direct manner, but it is actually a reference to that. You can see that splay of that space in the top on the long park here. You can see that splay there. You can see the way by which Coldrops and all of these buildings, which are all historic buildings, how they are actually integrally related with the new buildings that we are proposing. The sixth principle is, and there are only seven, it's the socioeconomic diversity and a sense of community and belonging. Because we feel that a good master plan must be long-lasting, but at the same time, and as a result of being a plan that actually lasts for a very long time, it must accommodate change. It must allow reuse. It must accommodate diverse socioeconomic groups, not only physically, but also socially and economically. And above all, it must exhibit a sense of community, a sense of belonging, whereby its public open spaces, that is, streets, squares, parks, gardens, whatever, must actually give people a variety of choice, a chance for delight, and also a sense of community. So this is the master plan as it actually stands now, rendered by Townsend, the landscape architect. And it is actually a very telling plan. You can actually see how the different blocks are actually articulating themselves a bit more rather than the kind of analytical drawings that I've shown you before. But you can see all the principles we've spoken about, almost all the principles being incorporated here. And that leads me to the last principle, which is that of placemaking. King's Cross is about people. It is about everyday life. And as such, I think it has recognizable places, each one with its own character, some distinct, even distinct character, or whoever knows what may actually happen in the future, as and when different architects actually build. Station Square, for example, may be a place of arrival. How it is actually described, we do not know yet. These are just images which are only indicative. And a place where which actually leads to the right all the way up the main boulevard to the north. Or the smaller square next to it may be a place of different sort of architectures mixed together or however it's actually rendered in the future, which actually has retail and offices. Along the canal, you can actually definitely have a blending between nature's beauty and the historic buildings and the new buildings, as is actually shown, at least the intention is shown in this drawing here, where you can actually see the new buildings, the fish and coal buildings on the left, plus also the really quite beautiful canal scenery. Or further up north, you can actually see the way by which housing, retail, and some offices are actually mixed. And I will leave you with this image here, which is, again, a latest model of the proposals. And Graham will actually take you through to explain the scheme much more analytically.
Well, I'm just going to take you for a short walk around the proposals. It's going to start at the southern end, which is at the left, work its way up through, across the main square, and then to the north, and then back down to the gas holders. So first of all, I'm going to turn this model round so the south is facing you. I hope. Yes, here it is. And this is really not a detailed analytical view. This is just to see a little bit about what it's like. And I think one of the things we should stress is that although you're seeing pictures of buildings, it's not about the architecture, that there is no way that a master plan should ever be intended to be prescriptive. It should be flexible, and it should accommodate many, many different sorts of people working there. But you have to draw something, because otherwise people don't understand it. And so that's why we've drawn some of the images. Now, so the first one is to start here at Station Square, and then we're going to go up the boulevard to here. So that's the slide that Dimitri has just shown you. It's a bit of overlap. There's the German gym, and that's the view, looking up the boulevard to the building, just inflecting slightly to lead towards the granary when you get to the top of the street. Closer in, we anticipate this is going to be a really busy place, that if there's 30,000 people potentially living on the site, that in fact they think that there might be 80,000 people added to that in the form of visitors and people working on the site. So it's a very significant population. Going further up the boulevard, this is a slightly out-of-date drawing, as this is intended to have a street for buses going back and forth. And this was an earlier rendition to show it pedestrianised. But you'll notice a London Underground logo there, because there's a new entrance to King's Cross Station taken as far north as we're able to carry it. Now, on the other side of that building, which was just here, it just leads to Pancras Square, which is the first small square around which a number of office buildings would be located. And that's a view of it. There's the underground insignia. That goes off to the granary in the distance, and in fact that route takes you to Camden. Now, turning the model sort of round on its side again, we started there and we've kind of worked our way up here. We're now going to look at the canal area. We'll look at the view from here, then dive into the Midland Goodshed, to the Handyside Canopies, as it's called, and then look at the square itself. And this is a view of the canal, with the taller buildings on the southern side and the granary on the right, and the kind of looseness of the waterway life in front of you. Just to the north, the Handyside Canopy restored, where there could be an open-air market. And then further along, with the canal at the foot of you, looking back at the restored granary with the new public square, which is of comparable in scale to Trafalgar Square. Having sort of looked at that, we're now going to go into the coal drop area. Remember that from that very first early slide, how busy this was in terms of industry, where this negotiates a serious change of level up to Market Square, just here. That's showing you the change of level with the existing buildings, where trains came in at a higher level and carriages came in at a lower level and took the goods away. But this offers a kind of restoration and reuse, not unlike Covent Garden itself. That's a view with the stairs at the end leading you up to what we call Market Square. And that's an image where, once you're at the top of those stairs, there could be a series of cafes producing a focal point for the whole of the northern area. We've now sort of pretty much, we sort of started here, we went up to there, went round, came through here, we've gone up that way to Market Square. We're now going to look at Long Park, which is very much like a London square. It's about 40 metres across on average and 170 metres long. And this has buildings on either side, but a public park in the centre. And you'll notice that very often cars are included in the pictures, because we don't think that streets are necessarily made safe by the absence of cars. They're made safe by the reduction in numbers and densities in cars. And then coming to the very top, that's Long Park just here, coming to the sort of apex of the scheme, we're going to go back down Canal Street, down towards the number 8 gas holder, the rebuilt gas holder. And this crescent loosely follows the embankment of the Eurostar railway coming into St Pancras. So this is a view looking back down towards the south with the empty number 8 gas holder that's being turned into a park. And then coming back into the canal, you see the number 8 gas holder on the left, but the triplets are going to be converted into apartment buildings where the inside of the original gas drum is effectively replaced by a series of buildings of different heights, almost mimicking the way the gas drums rose up and down. And then finally, the view, this is the tracks taking you into St Pancras with this almost this first impression of your arrival in London as you come out of the tunnel with the canal basin and the gas holders in the distance, the coal drops, and then the granary building in the distance as the canal snakes round. So absolutely, this sort of heritage forming a very significant part of what we're doing. And in summary, nearly at the end now, that this is the map of the streets that exist now. Here is the King's Cross area, and it's showing you where the numbers of streets that cross it. And this is the same map as it would be when the master plan was finished. And some of the connections are just impenetrable, and we could discuss that in more detail if you want to. But we feel what we've been able to do is to effectively revitalise part of the city that has no capacity for civilised use into one which does. And it'll turn an area that is essentially derelict. It's extraordinary to think this is one of the busiest parts of London. There's King's Cross and St Pancras. Here's the new cross-channel rail link coming through. That's York Way snaking its way around to come under the North London line through here. And then the main sort of industry of the site and the canal running through. But that would then turn into pretty much a bustling city, looking back towards the centre and the river in the distance. And as Dimitri quite rightly said, if it found its way in future years seamlessly onto the A to Z, and it felt that it was a perfectly legible, pleasant place to be, then the master plan will have been a success. Bob, I think we're going to stop there and hold on to you.
Thank you both very much. Not an easy job to mesh together two different approaches, but if the three panellists would like to come up first. And if I can invite Mike Edwards of the University College in Bartlett to give a response first off.
Thank you very much, Robert. I got 5 minutes and quite a lot of comments to try and put in. First of all, can I say what a pleasure it is to hear these two designers present their scheme. I have heard this scheme and its predecessors presented many, many times in the last couple of years, but always by their client, the developer, who actually presents it a bit as Sainsbury's might present an own brand product. You know, you don't ask which factory it was made in, it's his scheme. And I have never known a case as strong as this where the developer, the client, so takes on his professional team's work that he can present it as his own, and he does. I think actually the scheme would cut more ice in the locality if he asked you to do it. And if he did it himself. He's up there doing it this evening, and I'm missing his version this evening, but I'm very glad to be here. Now, two or three comments about it, really picking up, I think, on, in your banner for the series, this notion of impact. Because I'm an economist and a planner, and I'm thinking very much about the consequences and results of things we do to cities. My sense is that the design group here have done a very, very good job within the structural conditions offered to them. Two or three things about the structural conditions within which they're working. The first is this quite extraordinary phenomenon whereby certain important cities in the world, like London, become points of incredible concentration of money and capital and power. This is where the world's products turn into profits and incomes and wages and rents and get declared as GNP, and we seem to be very wealthy. And it's where investors love to invest because they can see all this happening, and they're quite happy to invest here in offices and luxury housing and all sorts of things at quite low yields because they regard it as very safe. So the city somehow is, in a way, benefiting from and blossoming under, but also burdened by this mass of investment. So that's one background structural thing which no one site, no one architect, no one planner can deal with, but as a city and as a city administration and a government and a nation, we have to think about it and consider it. The other is a very specific structural thing that the British government, in deciding, thank goodness, to change its mind and route the Channel Tunnel Railway, not under the centre of London in a tunnel, but on the new line that Arabs and others proposed through Stratford, a wonderful change of policy. But they decided, following the fashion for privatisation, to do it by setting up a private consortium which would build and operate the railway. And because it was never going to be profitable, it would need Treasury subsidy. But they were offered this piece of land at King's Cross and another piece at Stratford and another piece at Ebbsfleet, which is more or less blue water. And they could develop this land, and the profits from that would help to reduce the Treasury subsidy to the Channel Tunnel Railway operation. So the landowners here are under a very, very strong pressure from the Treasury to bring in as much as they can from the site. So whoever is working on design schemes for this side has to try and deliver the necessary level of profitability. And I think that slightly shows in the scheme, in the, well, we could discuss in the rest of the meeting what sort of things this scheme might have in. It sounds much more diverse and interesting in today's presentation than in other ones that I've heard. Now, let me just add two more points and I'll shut up. The first is that this particular patch of London, because it was derelict, abandoned for 60, 70, 80 years, really, The railways never invested, the public authorities never invested, private investors never invested. There are no corporate businesses, no new office buildings, one new hotel perhaps if you're lucky, but basically it's been a totally barren area with no investment for decades. Had accumulated a very interesting flora and fauna, I mean of people and businesses. A large population of white working class, very settled. A more recent population with Bengalis and Somalis and students and young professionals and all kinds of people coming and going. And a very curious and interesting population of businesses, small firms doing all manner of things, all these charities, human rights organizations, political bodies, civil rights lawyers, non-profits of all kinds. Because it was well, good accessibility, bit of central London, where property was incredibly cheap. So what's happening there now is this very rapid transition from an extremely, specially, peculiarly cheap area with all its flora and fauna to what is clearly going to be a beautiful, lavish, rather luxurious area, okay, with some protected bits of social housing and perhaps a few premises for small and medium enterprises somewhere in there. But you know, a very rapid, accelerated process of dramatic change. So the impacts are going to be very big. I don't think it can be done very well, however good the design. And I think there's going to be a lot of controversy and difficulty about it before it's finished. So it's wonderful to see the presentation, very interesting design. But structurally and in a wider context, I think it's a deeply alarming project.
Okay. Jeremy Melvin is here as a representative of the Royal Academy. He's been party to setting up this series of lectures, but has his independent view on this, I'm sure.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, Graham and me, and also I think Mike's comments, which add an insightful way of looking at the overall thing. But I'm not going to follow that specifically because I've got, I think, really some points which I think are generic to large-scale development in urban brownfield locations, but I think are so visceral at King's Cross that they really merit being just brought to the surface. And that's really to do with the whole role of infrastructure. That I think it became very clear from the presentation that this is a zone defined by infrastructure, and most of that infrastructure that is now technologically anachronistic. One could even argue, I think, I'm not sure how far one could get, that something like the rail link, the international rail link, is in fact an example of anachronistic technology, although I'm sure that people don't predict that. But the shape of that piece of land, not just its plan, but the manipulations of its ground level, what is actually ground level, which has probably changed several times in the last 150 years, all of that is determined by generations of attempts to make a big city work. The Regent's Canal is a way of distributing goods across the sort of north end, what was then the north side of London. The railways are a way of bringing coal, beer, corn, all those things that were found in the Midlands of the north of England into the centre of consumption, which London was becoming, had become by the time the railways were built. And indeed, that consumption, I think Mike may well be able to correct me on this, but I think that consumption was part of the economic process that allowed the financing of the railways in the first place. So London became a mall that needed to be satiated in some way. The sort of nasty growth in the intestine is what we have at King's Cross. And it doesn't mean it always will, because I think there are merits in this master plan. Indeed, they may well be the most effective urban surgeons that we've seen. But I think the sort of generic challenge of thinking about this infrastructure and the legacy of this infrastructure and the massive investments in infrastructure that we've done, not just, of course, the international terminal, but the rebuilding of the underground Wicket Hall at King's Cross, and there were other amendments, I believe, to King's Cross Station as well. This is actually something that is redefining the relationships between public and private space. And I think that one of the impressions that came to me from Dimitri, and I'd be very happy to hear your comments, possibly a contradiction to this, Dimitri, is that many of those principles seem to be rooted in a more traditional form of urbanism than that which is determined by this 19th and 20th century infrastructure. And I wonder whether we could raise the discussion, the way in which these massive infrastructural developments, the international terminal, the tube lines, the six tube lines, the 13 bus routes, actually redefine, or they should help us to define anew a notion of what public space is, and therefore a notion of what the public realm is, but also, very importantly, I think, what our private perceptions of that public space is. Clearly it's very different for someone who come in from Paris for the day, sees that sweep on the elevated viaduct, and then might sort of wander through the King's Cross development on their way to the city, or whatever they may be. So I think the relationship, what I'm suggesting is that it's not just a balance between public and private space. I'm suggesting that infrastructure is something that is incredibly important in redefining the relationship between public and private space.
Okay, thank you. And finally, Joanna Averley, who's Deputy Chief Executive of CAPE and very familiar with master planning schemes.
Thanks very much. I've got a few observations, and the first one is was said to me this week in a workshop when a series of developers said to me, well, you know, master plans are a bad thing. And of course I sort of thought, well, I wonder what they meant. And they thought that top-down master planning was a bad thing. And I sort of delved a bit and said, well, what exactly do you mean by that? And they sort of said, well, you know, master plans don't work, you know, if they're sort of overly prescriptive and they're not based on the needs of people. And I think those sorts of comments remind us of a couple of things which I sort of just want to dwell on for a moment. First of all, the point that master planning as a term gives people real problems. As professionals, we're very happy with the term. We're quite happy to be top down. We're quite happy to apply professional bias and professional judgment. But just a word of warning, it actually grates with people as a term. And I don't have a problem with it as a term because I'm a professional, but just bear that in mind. I'm really struck by King's Cross as a project and have been for a number of years in terms of the work that's been going on. And it reminds me of what I think are some of the key questions about master planning that we face in this country and I think internationally. I absolutely agree with the point about master plans needing to be flexible. And I think that's where people do have a significant misunderstanding about what master planning is as a positive process, in that it's not about a blueprint that a designer dreamed up, puts down on a plan, and is then delivered in total without any change, without any grain and detail coming later. The blueprint in master planning, in my mind, is dead. It's dead as a process. It doesn't take us where we want it to go, and it's dead actually in being a creative process. So I think Dimitri's propositions about balance and compromise actually sort of are at the heart of master planning for me. And the fact that you do have to plan, you have to have master plans for projects of this scale, because the master planning process itself creates the framework for dialogue and discussion and compromise. And also, going back to the views of developers, and this developer in particular was a volume house builder, facing up to the fact that they have responsibilities beyond profit. I think also master plans do set the standards, but have to accommodate change. And I think what's really striking about the design philosophy behind the King's Cross Master Plan is it does assume, as Dimitri very strongly said, a European urban density. And in some senses, it challenges us to think about, can you go too dense? Can you go too high? If you go back to the title of all the talks that we're part of. And I think the point that Mike said about the relationship between density and profitability is also a debate we could have for a very long time, and particularly density related to tall buildings related to profitability, but that's probably for another day. At CAVE, we've got a test that we often use in looking at a master plan, and this is, again, back to flexibility and adaptability. What would happen if only a part of the master plan were delivered? Would it still work? Would you still be able to come back in 10 years' time? And if the answer to that question is no, you can only deliver it as a set piece, then you have a problem. And that actually basically underlines the fact that megastructures are not the future. Megastructures in master plans usually fail. Master plans also have to create a view of the future. And it's a long-term future. If Roger Madeline, the developer, were here, he would say this is a 20-year plan. And I think King's Cross is actually an easy project. Sorry, Graham. Sorry, Dimitri. And I'll tell you why I think it's an easy project for a designer. It's because it's a place with context. It's a place with heritage. It's a place with a grain that it can build off and build around. And I think the infrastructure, while being big scale, actually causes a response. Master plans are much more difficult where you have limited context. They're also much more difficult where you have limited market. That's another thing that makes King's Cross relatively easy, aside from the profitability and CGRL issues. The other challenge is that master plans have to be uniquely of themselves. They have to be of the place. And again, King's Cross gives lots of signals as to what makes King's Cross unique. So, sort of in summing up, master planning is easier in King's Cross than other places, but it isn't an easy process. Internationally, master plans have to be careful that they don't sweep away the very grain and grit that makes a place work. There's a fantastic little saying which says, you know, you need a bit of grit because it stops you from tripping up. So understanding how the grit of a place informs the design of a master plan is absolutely vital. And a final word on flexibility and prescription. A fantastic little thing written up in a pub in Dorset, which said, be strong in what you stand for, be careful in what you fall for. The King's Cross Master Plan knows what it's standing for. It knows what has to be delivered in terms of public space. I hope going forward that it is very careful in the detailed design that comes forward, because everything can be lost in the detail, in fact. And finally, in terms of the client role, master plans need champions. Again, if Roger Madeline were here, he's rather hilarious. He can literally tell you the numbers of public meetings he has been to and the numbers of hands he has shaken. And it's in the thousands, I think, now. So it is a unique project in that respect, in terms of very little light between the design aspiration of the designer and the commitment of the client, which, again, is an absolute prerequisite.
Okay, thank you very much. Well, would the two protagonists like to join us up here and explain why they too feel that designing King's Cross was easy? And I think just a brief response, if you can, to that, so that we can invite commentary. But,
Shall I go first? Okay. Well, I just have something to say about each of them. Is that Mike went first. His first view, I have some sympathy with it, because if you live anywhere, you get worried about change. And there's no question that all areas of London, they become settled and enjoyable, and they describe a character. And I guess the difficulty or the difference between us is that we as designers are in the business of change. And I mean, I've read and reread Peter Ackroyd's book on London, and it's just fascinating to see how great waves of change constantly sweep London, and how, as a city, it just gets better and better. I don't think that necessarily challenges Mike's view, but it's certainly an alternative way of looking at it. With Jeremy's comments, I think one of the points that you were making, is in relation to the nature of a place and how maybe we're doing something over traditional and there isn't something special enough coming from King's Cross that's from its place. And I'm reminded, in fact, of the area around the Tate, Britain, which I don't know if you know, that was a prison. And if you follow the path on which the Tate sits, you'll see there's all sorts of angled streets which form the octagon of the prison walls. And it was the last staging post before prisoners were transported to Australia. And I think, again, that areas simply overtake the memory of what was there before. And if there's something valuable, then you respond to it. And if you feel, actually, that you're inheriting a whole series of problems, which in King's Cross we certainly are, and there is much to do with connection as incorporating history, then it's a sort of different view. And I know when we did a project at the White City that, I mean, there the original running track had been there, and it didn't seem to us to be a real determinant. And in fact, I think what we've tried to do is work with the spaces at King's Cross and the history of King's Cross to make something that's right, but is also of London. And then the last thing to do is Joe, I'm taking too long, aren't I? Yeah, the last thing of, I've got the stare, from Joanna, is that I completely agree with all the things that she's saying about master planning, and I think that actually it's a real test of any master plan that you can forward a piece of infrastructure and you're making a real difference, you actually make a real connection, and that's a very good test about being able to do part, though it's not always true, because sometimes you're dealing with such new things that in fact you've got to get to a critical point or a critical mass before you can judge whether it's being successful. And the devil being in the detail, that's true. But there is every intention at King's Cross to employ a great many of what I would call very good architects to see that the detail continues through to completion.
Dimitri, very briefly, please.
How briefly?
Well, you talk and I'll tell you when to stop. How about that?
I'm actually reminded about that story where somebody's actually going to a wedding with like a schedule for wedding, everything is fine or not fine or whatever, and then somebody says, what do you think of the wedding? What do you think? And they said, I don't think. So what do you mean you don't think? Well, I don't think because I think the institution of marriage is outdated. Okay, forget the parables. More specifically, with Mike, I can fully appreciate and I can see the anxiety and the worries about what you beautifully actually described, too much profitability, aimed at a very specific little piece of land, not that little, but I can see the point, in a very, very, very short period of time, would probably agree with Graham on that point. The issue is what do you do with that space? I think, what do you do? How do you actually address it? And is it possible to mitigate negativity or not? On the issue of density, however, I mean, on the issue of density, one should be reminded that the project that we're actually proposing has like 4.1, 4.2 plot ratio. For those who actually are not planners or architects here, physically planners, plot ratio is the ratio between the plot that you have, the land that you have, and how much land you build. So let's say you have like 1 square meter of plot, yes, of land, and you build 1 square meter of buildings, that is N1 plot ratio, etc., etc. So the plot ratio is like 4.1, 4.5. Let's actually remember that Mayfair is a 2.6 plot ratio. Let's actually remember that the city is, I think it's about 4.5, no, the city is about 5 to 7, I think. It varies in one place to another. But let's remember that Paris, the Paris of Haussmann, of Haussmann, yes, the Grand Boulevards, it's actually a plot ratio of 6, 6.5. Now, what I'm actually saying here, and that opens up another discussion, is the discussion of, does density mean necessarily high rise? My belief, and I think, well, our belief, is that you should deliver density, because there's just no way you can actually do a project today unless you deliver density. That's the factor. If you want two stories, you cannot deliver two stories on that piece of land. That land is too expensive to deliver two stories. So you will have to actually deliver high density, but we went for low rise to mid rise. In other words, we went for 5 stories to 9 or 10 stories in certain areas. And other schemes have actually gone for actually greater density with a high rise. We haven't actually opted for that, so that's something to keep, I suppose, in mind.
Can we perhaps, if we leave it there, and then we can maybe use that as a hinge to get a response? Is there a burning question from? Yes, thank you. Is someone going to bring a microphone?
You have talked about embedded heritage, and I wondered, has there been any architectural design guidelines for the master plan, or just planning regulations for the development? And how does the new development fit within the heritage?
Well, there have been. You see, as Graham actually very, very well actually described, a master plan should not aim at defining buildings. It should not aim at defining styles. However, when you actually draw something, you cannot draw it without actually showing some character, and your hand is different from mine and vice versa, etc., etc. So all these different sorts of images that you have, yes, indeed, it is something that actually says that as this master plan is populated, as this master plan is built, it will take whatever the fashion of the day is. You cannot avoid that. So there are guidelines, and the guidelines have to do with heights, have to do with densities, have to do with breadths and widths and this and that, but it does not really have to do with style. And I'm stressing this because, as we do know today, new urbanism, the whole kind of traditional tendency of new urbanism has actually gone the other way totally, whereby they define specifically what sort of ratios of height to width you may have in your windows. Well, that is not really what we're talking about here, is it?
No. Graham, go on.
Yeah, I think it's a really good question, actually, because when we first took on the commission to do a master plan, we sort of rubbed our hands thinking, oh, we've never done a master plan, this is great. But we very quickly realised that we have often worked within the limitations of master plans, and instead of trying to determine briefs for particular sites that make claims or aspirations to something sensible or worthy, we were always being told that the building shall be exactly 14.7 metres high, and at 12.3 metres there'll be a cornice projecting out, and it'll be made of a particular kind of stone and a particular kind of brick. And that these are the rules that have nothing to do with the aspirations that we're aiming for. Now, as far as the heritage buildings are concerned, which is a really important issue, there are no rules at all in the master plan except the things that govern the infrastructure framework and the overall heights of certain buildings, but even then it's quite flexible, or the widths of the streets. And even blocks can turn from being residential to offices depending on the market, provided the overall mix is then that we're submitting for planning is then met. And I think that's very worthy. But our experience as architects, and certainly our experience of good architects, is that if you get a good designer responding to an existing or old building, that you leave it to them, and then you make the judgments when they come up with the design, because none of these buildings have got planning permission. They all have to go through a complete process of detailed design, and that's exactly right. So what you're really setting up is a system as if you've almost got the city made, and now everybody comes along and does a proper planning application. So they start from a position of almost a first base on that. And then they've got a context in which they can think and respond. And I'm sure that's the right way to proceed.
Joanna, just a response and then we'll get another question.
I just wanted to add sort of procedural point to that. I think what is interesting about the King's Cross project is it does set precedents about how to deal in regulatory planning terms with a project of this scale, this nature, with this much heritage over the timescale that we're looking at. And what Dimitri was pointing out is in terms of the principles, is all embedded in a document, which is forms part of the background to the proposals. And so it's a project that, in planning and regulatory terms, does rely heavily on principles rather than and the structure of the master plan, but not the detailed architecture. And it's worth noting that in heritage terms, that has actually been quite challenging because we're dealing with listed buildings where you usually can't make a decision unless you have a detailed proposal in terms of the impact on listed structures. So it's been it's been actually setting important precedents about dealing with long-term planning, heritage, and setting principles on this sort of scale.
Okay. Yes. Just wait for the microphone for a second.
Just wanted to refer to the idea of the human city. In a way, in the image, the human city was kind of four stories high, kind of city as we all know. And you are trying, I think, to redefine the idea of a human city. So how is it going to be defined? What are our regulations, or in what way is it going to be a real human city?
Well, I mean, I thought I actually made some reference to it. But a human city is not necessarily four and five stories. It is a four and five story city, maybe human, maybe inhuman. We've seen four and five stories in the 1920s, not all of them, some of them, at least two that I do like a lot, which were extremely inhuman. And we've seen actually cities which are like 10, 15, 20 stories, which are perfectly human. For me, New York is a human city. Now that's, I throw that in as a scandalous proposition, but I do actually believe that New York is a human city. It has Midtown, which has X, has downtown, has uptown, has east, west, and it is the most amazing place, and the densities are high, and they move up and down, etc. What makes the city, what makes New York, I'm taking an extreme case, we're not doing New York here, but what makes New York totally human in my mind is that the first two stories, the first three stories, the first four stories, the first five stories, the five or six stories that rightly so you mentioned, the 19th and 18th century New York is actually there. You can see it. You can glimpse your eye and you can actually see it. You can see that line going through, and that has a totally different scale from anything else. And in fact, the best blocks in New York are the ones where the skyscrapers are actually 2 or 3 meters further in, because it doesn't actually matter. So you feel confident and you feel comfortable and you feel enclosed and you feel perfect. The problem of New York, of not being human, is there is no public open space as a stationary space other than the park, unless you go downtown. You see what I mean? So I don't think it's a matter of height. I think it's a matter of how you actually create, at the level of the pedestrian, at the level of the person who actually walks down the street, the right ambiance and the right enclosure and the right feeling that that person or persons will actually feel comfortable. But I mean, and also in our case, as I said, you know, we vary between 6, 8, and 12 stories. That's really the maximum we have, isn't it?
Dimitri never ceases to be a pleasant surprise, actually, I think, in terms of his happiness with tall buildings. Yes.
Jarvis, for the mic. Oh, thanks very much. I listened with great interest to Dimitri setting out the seven principles which underlay the overall strategy of the scheme. Not least because I was struck by the similarity of those principles quite explicitly with those that are set out by Jane Jacobs and a little bit by Lynch, but particularly Jane Jacobs in her book in 1961. Now, first of all, I'd like to ask you if there is a direct kind of influence there. It seems to me there is. And secondly, These principles, if we're talking about 1,000 years, and you were, they ought really to have some sort of foundation. Jacob promises in her theory that it's thoroughly empirically grounded. But as you know, in recent years, there's some controversy now surrounding her theory. So one, am I right that there is a direct linkage between those principles you enunciated and those of Jacob's? And secondly, have you taken into account the controversy surrounding her work?
Yeah, there may be references or relationship with Jane Jacobs, but that's not really the significant thing. That was an ephemeral life. What is significant is the millennia that actually preceded that text, and that continuity of all of those millennia, and the way by which, no matter what sort of changes actually happened between classical Greece or Rome in 21st century, there are fundamental human principles that we all feel happy, comfortable, etc., and which actually have still maintained. I'm not saying there has been no change. Of course there have been change, dramatic change. But the beauty about change is that it actually shows what has actually stayed and remained. The fact that we all still eat bread still, and we cherish that, or at least I do, it's actually quite significant. So that's, in my view, that's the first. But you're right, yes, there are references. Vis-a-vis the second question about whether one has actually taken into account the dramatic changes of contemporary life, I think one has. You see, I teach at Yale also, on and off, 14, 15 days a year. And I was a very good friend of Jim Sterling's, and I've actually taken that position because he was gracious enough to actually recommend me to go there, believe it or not. And what is interesting, I think, is that students actually say, oh, well, you're a traditionalist, or you're a classicist, or you're a rationalist, or you're like, I don't know, whatever they figure out one is. How do you come from Europe? You know, do you actually take the plane? Of course I take the plane. It's absurd not to take the plane. You see what I'm trying to say? It's absurd not to actually use a computer. It's absurd not to actually have great belief and trust in any of the greater sort of breakthroughs that contemporary technology has done. But one should not actually confuse one species of things with another species of things. And so in that sense, I don't think that the scheme that we're actually proposing here is traditional. On the contrary, I think the scheme is actually modern. It is a veritably modern scheme.
Yes.
I was wondering, in order to deliver the kind of profitability that Mike Edmonds was talking about, you've obviously had to shoehorn in an awful lot of net lettable floor area in between the stations on some of the higher value land on the site. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the extent to which you were constrained by strategic viewing corridors, whether in fact that was a constraint on you or not in that location, and whether that informed your decision to go for ground scrapers rather than, sorry to bring you back to height, but ground scrapers versus skyscrapers.
Yeah, one of the several thousand slides that we didn't show you was the strategic view corridor, and you're quite right. We have two cones that cross the site, but they're quite a bit above the height of our tallest building, so it wasn't a direct constraint. It would be disingenuous if I didn't happen to know the very small triangles of land that are free of the corridor, and I know where you could put a tall building, because that's one of the things you have to analyse. And I think it's taking your viewpoint, I mean, you use the word shoehorn, and you know, so it does sort of suggest where you're coming from. And the other way of looking at it, it is the land that's most popular and is likely to generate the highest value. And I know capitalism's meant to be bad and all that, but it generally does follow what people desire. And in terms of urban planning, provided you have it under control, that you aren't making spaces that are inhuman, that they all work and they have the right widths. You know. So, for example, the area you're talking about in the southern section is wider than Oxford Street, throughout its length. That's one of London's very wide streets. It's no denser than other areas of London. And in a funny way, in relation to the last question about Jane Jacobs, just to tie the two together, is that of course we've all read Jane Jacobs, and of course we're influenced by our clients, but the best teacher is London itself, because we have all the mistakes you need to see in front of us, and all of the good things about it too, and you just need to walk around and absorb it, and you can make these tests and comparisons very easily. So I don't think we're shoehorning land into there, but I wholeheartedly accept that the density increases where it's more popular.
Okay, I think that might be a useful place to halt. I think that I know there are many, many more questions, but this is a part of one lecture in a series. The next lecture is on tall buildings in the City of London, in particular, that Lee Polizano of KPF is going to be talking at, and I think that's on the 10th of November, from memory. And then the lecture after that by Richard McCormack is going to be talking about public realm improvements. He's looking at Victoria Embankment. And so we'll go on then into the period after Christmas. And the idea is to provide transcripts from these lectures and to ideally produce a publication at the end of the six. So please return, please bear in mind some of these comments and redirect them at the next lecture in a few weeks' time. But meanwhile, if we could thank very much both Graham and Dimitri and the three panellists, Mike, Joanna and Jeremy. Thank you very much.